Let me tell you about my guest this month on The Process. Anna Ray is a North Carolina-based independent filmmaker. She is the founder and creative producer for Portrayed Productions, an independent production company dedicated to telling Black Southern stories through an intersectional lens. I met Anna Ray when we both happened to be working on creative projects at the same cafe in Wilmington, North Carolina. A few days later, I brought my portable recording setup to her studio, and this episode was born. In this interview, we talk about the real cost of creating a web series, and I just wanted to note that Anna Ray, as well as her producing and writing team, didn't receive payment for their work on the series. It was really a labor of love from the top down. That's why they're planning a crowdfunding campaign, so they'll be able to pay the creative team and crew for their talents, time, and dedication. To learn more, you can follow Portrayed Productions and subscribe to their newsletter at the link in the show notes of this very podcast episode. There's a lot to dig into here, and I know you'll enjoy it, so here we go. Why are you creating art? Like, what's this urge? What does it feel like?
I descend from like a long line of storytellers, just in general. Obviously, filmmaking is a newer medium. It has only existed for like 100-ish years. But like, my whole family has been storytellers. My aunt is a oral storyteller. She does like folk storytelling in like storytelling circuits in the Southeast. My ancestors were storytellers. Like, even my enslaved ancestors were known for telling stories. And so like, I just feel like it's in my blood, the sense of like wanting to capture human experience right now and pass it on. Like, there's so much history that isn't even written, that's orally told from generation to generation. It doesn't make it any less valid, any less worthy, but like, there's just so much wrapped into the art of telling a story. And I don't think I had a choice. I think it was something that was like down the line given to me as just being part of my family. And I'm not saying like we're fancy or anything like that. Quite the opposite, because a lot of the storytellers in my family were oral storytellers. Like, they do all these folklore stories, and like they do like cultural festivals and stuff like that. When I was doing like some genealogy stuff, one of my ancestors, there was an article published in like the newspaper from 1921 about him telling the stories of when he was enslaved.
Wow.
And like, a lot of the work he did was being around speech, being able to tell stories and articulate and communicate. And I just think it's who I am. I don't know any other way to describe it.
Wow. How do you feel like your personal experience is shaping the way you tell this history in stories?
For me, a lot of like the themes, a lot of the stories that I gravitate towards and like to develop are very much rooted in culture. And I think that is part of just lived experience. My grandma grew up in Jim Crow South. I listened to a lot of conversations about what that era was like here. And stories, not even all just like rooted in trauma, because a lot of times when you hear stories and you hear Jim Crow or you think slavery, like all of it is immediately like trauma. But like, the way my grandma and like her brothers and sisters would talk about it, it was just the setting. The setting was just the Jim Crow South. There was still joy that was existing in this non-joyous period of time. Little things, you know, like kids playing and like taunting and like just like normal things that are still existing today. But like, there was this just cultural underbed, and like, it was always a connecting piece for me, for my sister. There was just this embedded, rooted sense of self that came out of hearing stories about the people that came before us. And like, I think that's why I tell story. That's my why. And I think if I didn't have those personal experiences, if I didn't grow up with parents and grandparents to let us listen in, because a lot of parents don't, a lot of grandparents don't, like, there's certain things that they don't want to expose their children to or want them to hear. And I think that's fine. But like, my parents, I'm sure there's plenty of things that they didn't say, but like, the things that they did let us hear became part of who we are. And so like, my personal experiences definitely like shaped me as a storyteller. And I always say I'm a storyteller first and film is just my medium.
I love how you're saying that your sense of self has been shaped by the stories that mm-hmm. you have heard from your family, and that now you are infusing all of your stories that you're creating with yeah. that sense of self. That's amazing.
Yeah.
What are you working on that you're really excited about right now?
Oh my God. So right now I'm working on my first big, and I use big in air quote because big in film means like billions and bukus of dollars.
Right, right.
Independent big.
Yep.
Okay. So like poor people big. project. It's a web series.
Yep.
It is about a Black girl in the South who has become this lifestyle-based influencer. She and her fiance get into an argument about taking his last name or not. And it kind of spirals into this journey for her about uncovering family history, family trauma, what mm-hmm. identity means, what being a modern woman in this ideal of taking last names or taking your partner, this expectation, what that looks like, especially in a place like the South where there is still a lot of conservative value and there's still a lot of things wrapped up into that. And it's not necessarily bad or good, but the point of the web series for me was to explore the conversation.
Mm.
And so it is slated to be 8 episodes for a full first season. We have shot the first 2 episodes. We're in post-production on the first 2 episodes. I am excited that we're getting a crowdfunding campaign for the rest of the season together. So that will be on the way, and yeah, and then we're going into development on episodes 3 through 8, and hopefully with a solid crowdfunding campaign, shameless plug, with a hopefully a release campaign on time, we will be shooting the rest of it in probably the early parts of 2024.
You are a creator and you need money to create, and you also have to live a life and like feed yourself and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How the fuck do you stay balanced doing all that stuff? Do you stay balanced? Do you have any routines that you do, or?
Yeah, so like the balance is a WGA strike. No, I'm just joking. So to pay the bills, mm-hmm. I have been working on big budget productions in various departments to make ends meet. The thing about that, and anybody that is listening to this podcast that does like production crew work, is those are long days. Those are 60 right. hour work weeks.
Oh wow.
Those are early mornings and late nights, and outside of Saturday and Sunday where you're trying to catch up on the sleep that you lost in a 60 hour work week, there's not a lot of room for creation, to be honest. Like you're just exhausted by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been trying to balance ebbs and flows in between projects. When I'm on a show, then I more than likely, unless there is like a grant or something like that, that I'm just trying to crank out a proposal for or an application for a fellowship, something like that, where I'm like pushing. I more than likely I'm not doing a lot of creating in that window of time. And but then you'll get this window where the show wraps and you may or may not have the next show coming. And in those times is when I'm like 100% dedicated to me as an independent artist. That's when I do a lot more of my screenwriting. It's when I do a lot more of my organization of production company. It's when I do a lot more of my personal development stuff, like taking any master classes or workshops or webinars or all that stuff. That's kind of how I balance like the indie space that pays me nothing but makes my heart happy and sing versus the part where also makes me happy. Don't get it twisted, but like it's the bill payer.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, I cuddle my dog and I cry.
Yeah. Yes. Crying is so good.
Yeah, it is. It's so very good. Therapeutic. I'm a Cancer though. So I love to cry. I'm a crybaby Cancer.
I feel you.
But yeah, I cuddle my
rising.
Dog. Mm-hmm. It's very cathartic to cry.
Yeah,
people
totally.
They don't like to cry, but.
I know. Well, I even stop myself from crying in front of people. I'm like, what am I doing?
Like, what, like it's the most human emotion you have
yeah.
is to show feeling and empathy. And people don't like to do it because they think it's a sign of weakness.
I know.
But like it's a sign that you're still alive and you're still empathetic and you're still touching another human's soul or another human soul is touching you, you know?
Mm.
So I love crying. It's a good release of just all of the woes that life can be very heavy from time to time. But I digress. Yeah.
No, that was really necessary. Yeah. A necessary digression.
Yeah, and also I knit.
Yes, you knit.
Yeah, I'm a knitter. I'm a big knitter. So just having another creative outlet that's not so long form and so much stake and so much stress. It's also helpful just to be able to like sit down and do something tactile, because also film can be very digital and very long form, and like you work on it for days or weeks or months. You know, in this project, I came up with a concept in 2021 and I'm just now getting into production in 2023.
Right.
And then I won't get out of post probably until early 2024. And then I still have another 6 episodes to get down the pipeline. So like, it's such a long, non-tactile, you don't see a lot of the fruit of the labor until much later down the line process with film. The knitting is such a relief because, like, I knit, and in 30 minutes, it's just a little bit longer than when I started. It's just a little bit taller. Like, the sleeve is just a little bit more formed. Mm-hmm. And it's like you see it immediately. The gratification for the labor is immediate. And it's just such a refreshing art form in comparison.
I love that. While you were saying that, I was realizing, like, that's why I love cooking.
Yeah.
Because it's an immediate
gratification
thing,
like, versus, like, a lot of other art forms, you work and work and work and you chip at it and you chip at it and you chip at it. And, like, you're spending days, weeks, months, years crafting this thing, whether it's a film or an album or, you know, like a dance or choreography or whatever. You spend so much time getting it into its final form that a lot of times for me, by the end, you're just relieved that it got done and you don't even like take the time to be like, I'm so proud of this product, because you're just like, oh,
exactly,
finally I can breathe again. Because like, so for the past year and a half, all I've been doing is eating, sleeping, this thing.
Someone likened finishing a creative project as like birthing.
Yes. And you're just,
I don't
like,
remember who,
it's,
but
yeah, it's here. It's just here. Like, for good, for bad, regardless of the outcome, it's here, finally. Mm-hmm. After all the paperwork, after all the conversations, after all the meetings, after all the trying to if, ands, and buts, and figure out how we're going to solve the if, ands, and buts, and after all the people wrangling, which I love to say, but, like, after all of the, like, oh, you only got 30 minutes on this Tuesday, and of course it doesn't work with anybody else that only... like, that's working on this project. All of them only have this Thursday, but you're impossibly available on this Thursday.
Right.
You know, like,
yep.
After all of that, and then you get this thing, and you're just like, thank God. But, like, knitting, it's just, like, row by row.
Yep.
In 30 minutes, it's just a little bit wick. And it's still a longer form. Like, there's things that are shorter than knitting, but still, it's, like, I just see the gratification for the work so much quicker. And so it's just such a relieving thing. So also just balancing it with other creative outlets.
That's exactly what we need to hear. I want to kind of like get away from the nitty gritty stuff and dive into like the meat and potatoes of what you're doing, like the stories that you're telling. What are you trying to normalize in our world and our media with the stories that you're telling?
For me, one of the things that I found very interesting, and I can tell you a whole origin story, but really what it roots down to is I think our media gets the existence of Black people in the South wrong.
Tell me more.
Like, there's this idea, and a lot of times when people just hear the American South, they immediately go to like hillbilly, white, poor, conservative, racist, backwards. Like, all these negative connotations immediately come to the American South, but also all of these conversations also completely erase the Black and Indigenous people who still reside in the South. Matter of fact, the majority of Black Americans in this country live below the Mason-Dixon line. So, like, how can we have conversations about the South and also not talk about the existence of the Black? Like, how can you say this section of the country is racist and ignore the people of which they would be racist to? And so, like, for me, one of the big driving forces for a lot of my stories is debunking this idea of like the whitewashing of the American South. Mm-hmm. Because also there's a lot of revolutionary things that have come out of the South. Most of our civil rights movements have come out of the South. Most of our revolution has come out of the South. A lot of our activism stems from the South. So like, and a lot of those are riding on the back of Blacks and brown communities that exist within the South. And so like, we have to talk about that, because I also grew up with art is also a form of activism. Mm-hmm. So like, we also have to be able to have the space to talk about that and to share not only the traumas of Black people, because when you do talk about the Black South, a lot of times we go straight to Jim Crow and slavery. We have to revolutionize what that is, because there are still modern Black people who are finding success in the South. There is still Black people who are pushing activism in the South. There are still Black people who are living prosperous lives in the South. And I think in order for us to really talk about making the collective better as like the United States and progressing as a country as a whole, you have to do it to your quote unquote lowest, you know, denominator.
Right.
And if you talk to anyone else, they're like, it's the quote unquote South,
right.
But then we do nothing to revolutionize. As a matter of fact, what we do is continue to push the narrative that it's unsavable or it's unforgivable or it's behind the times, or there's this convoluted woe is me existence of Black and brown people there. And that's just not simply the case. And so like, a lot of the stories that I talk about, or like the stories that I gravitate towards, are about Black and brown people who are living prosperous lives in the South, but also tackling modern issues that globally or generationally we're having conversations about. We're having conversations about land loss and what land loss looks like for Indigenous or Black populations. We're having conversations about feminism and what last names mean to modern women. Mm-hmm. But Black women a lot of times are not in these conversations, and especially Black Southern women are not in these conversations. Or we forget that when we're talking about the housing crisis, that we're also not talking about these Black and brown and Indigenous people who are also losing their native lands or tribal lands, or like lands that were passed down through heirs' property from slavery. Like, we're not talking about them when we're talking about people being priced out or gentrification. We always go straight to these hyper populist, super urban, usually not Southern, because we also tend to not think that gentrification applies to the South, but it does.
Interesting.
But we're just not having those conversations. So a lot of the conversations and stories I like to tell are rooted in the existence of Black and brown people below the Mason-Dixon line, and modernizing and revolutionizing their stories so they're not just these woe is me, the helps, you know, the Jim Crows, the trauma porns. So
wait, trauma porns. I've never heard that word.
Trauma porn. Trauma porn is this idea of like stories that people like to see about certain groups of people being rooted in pain and trauma. And it happens even in white stories too. A lot of the times when you talk about the South, the first story that comes to mind is like the trailer park, the ghettos, domestic violence, sexual abuse. And that's how they set the story. Everything is around this pain. And a lot of the times, that is what people are like, clap, clap, clap. We're really getting into the nitty gritty of the human existence.
Yeah.
And I think those stories are important. I think there is a space for that. But where there becomes a problem is when we only tell stories like that for certain demographics of people. That's more of a Southern thing. It happens a lot in the Southern things. A lot of the things, if you start thinking about the stories that are placed in the South, some of the ones that are most revered, most of them probably have a root in LGBTQ trauma, racism, sexual assault, domestic violence, this ideal of need for escapism. Mm. And those stories are what I group as quote unquote trauma porn.
Wow. Okay. So part of what you're doing is moving away from that into a space of more joy and full humanity.
Mm-hmm. You can still tackle those issues.
Right.
But the root of that character's existence, the root of that story's existence, does not necessarily have to be rooted in that.
That makes sense. Hmm. Wow. So you're creating these stories. Mm-hmm. You're revolutionizing the media image and therefore the general public's image of Southern Black and Brown and Indigenous people in terms of like how they're living, how they're prospering. When you're working on something, mm-hmm. how are you bringing that mentality into the process?
Well, a lot of it is the way that I have been taught to view the world. And so, like, I don't know if it's a conscious decision, because here's the thing, and this is where a lot of people, I think, get it wrong, right?
Okay.
Like, there's this idea that poor people are just downtrodden about being poor. The reality of the situation is poor people are still finding joy in poverty. There are still little things that they are doing to make their existence worth living. That's just the reality of the situation. And so from the outside looking in, you're like, oh, well, these people must have angst and this stress and this thing. Because from where you're sitting on the outside, if you were in their place, you would have those things. That's not necessarily always the case, though. And so when I am creating, especially about things that, like, for example, I've never been married. I've never been engaged. I have no idea as far as what that conversation is like with a person that you truly love. But I do know this, right? I do know what it's like to grow up with two last names. And I do know what a struggle that identity was growing up. I do know what it's like to be a modern woman that has been building a career for herself. And I do know what it's like to have the pressures of being in the South and this idea and expectation that you just inherently, the MRS degree, if you will, this idea that, like, it doesn't matter how much work you have done until you've secured that MRS degree and got a man to get down on one knee for you. Like, that is the sign of true success. So, like, it was more a conversation that friends of mine had where we're just like, you know, at this point, we are professionals in various industries. We've gotten master's degrees. We've done all these things. If you get married right now, how do you feel about last name? And so for some people, it's like, you know, neither here nor there. I want to be one with my partner. And so taking his last name just feels like a no-brainer. And that's fine. There's some people that are like, I was born this person. This was the identity that I have connected and I've built. And, like, that is the framing of which I see myself, and I don't want to change that for another person. There's some people that are like, I'll take his last name legally, but I won't take it creatively, or I'll take it legally, but I won't take it professionally. And, like, there's just so many ways to do it. But, like, this is a new conversation. Women weren't having this conversation. Even our mom's generation wasn't really having this conversation. Our grandparents' generation definitely wasn't having this conversation. If you got married, you took his last name and that was it. Unless it wasn't, like, in the cultural rules, but you abide by the cultural rules and regulations. I'm speaking from Black American. You take his last name and that's it. Like, you don't even think twice about it. But, like, these are conversations now, but there's not a lot of conversation in the media. There's not a lot of storytelling about it. And so I just wanted to dig a little deeper into that and, like, actually explore what family name means, because part of the reason why it matters so much, especially in the South, is because family names mean stuff here. Like, you walk down the street and see somebody's last name on a building here. You know, it matters. And even, like, my grandparents would be like, oh, yeah, that's, like, one of the, you know, blank last names, or one of the this, that, and the third last names. And it groups you in, whether you want to be in or out, you know, like. And so, and it's like, she doesn't mean anything by it. It's just like, she grew up where, like, they had this set of family and that set of family and this, that, and the third. And once you married in, like, you're just part of that family now. And, like, when somebody died, it's like, oh, yeah, ain't that one of the blanks? Or, like, if someone's getting married, oh, yeah, they're marrying into the blank family. Just is what it is.
And there's a whole image that comes around.
There's images. Yeah. Like, and so I wanted something to explore that, because now it's different.
And it's also, it sounds like you're exploring it from the woman's perspective, which 100%. Is also not done very often.
No, because I think it's just like an expectation. And we don't get a chance to really explore the expectation a lot. It's either we do it because the guy wants us to do it and that's fine, or we don't do it and we're being rebellious and we're being angry and we are being feminist, air quotes, because I know it's a podcast. but air quote feminist, and like there's this form of rebellion, but like sometimes it's a bit more nuanced and a bit more technical and a bit more challenging, and like I just wanted something that explored that and also would explore what a lot of people like. We tote names that we identify with and we don't even understand what we're identifying with. Like, we don't even understand our family's full history sometimes. We don't understand the traumas that are associated with our own names, or like the positives that are associated with our own names. So I just wanted something to that digged into that.
Yeah. I'm so excited to see it.
Yeah, I'm really excited for people to see it.
Oh my gosh.
Although it's a very quote unquote heavy subject, I'm using a lot of air quotes in this, but it's really fun. Like, it's actually very fun. I don't know. It's not like this heavy thing where it's just like, I just can't be with him because he wants me to have it. Like, it's funny.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you're exploring it in like a multifaceted way. It's not just like, yeah. Oh, I'm so excited to see it. Oh my gosh. For people who don't know about filmmaking, okay. Like me, I don't know anything about filmmaking.
Oh, welcome to the world of spending a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, so what are you spending money on? Like, what does it actually cost you to make this web series?
Okay, so...
give us all the dirty details.
All the dirty, gritty, nasty details. Yeah. Okay, so when I originally slated this project, it was a very bare, the barest of bone budget. $3,000.
Okay.
Bare bones.
Yeah.
That did not pay my crew. That barely paid for meals. That was a very extremely tiny rental fee for equipment. It barely paid for lodging. It did not pay for casting. It paid for basically nothing. It basically paid for 10 of my friends, 3 of which to get in front of the camera and also act for me, like, and do 7 other positions for me, and then feed them, and maybe if one of my friends has a camera, I can pay them to borrow it for a week.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And a light.
Right. And a singular light.
And one singular light and one singular microphone that all of my actors will have to share.
Yes.
Obviously, that budget was not realistic.
Right.
I think after, and I ended up shooting the first 2 episodes together, I think afterwards, I probably am somewhere around 15K.
Okay.
For 15K episodes for 2 episodes. We're looking at $15,000. Okay. Also, my episodes are 10 to 15 minutes long. So we're not also talking about full length episodes. We're talking about very much cut for the internet, so much shorter.
This is why I want to talk about this, because it does take so
It takes so much money
to put this stuff out.
It takes so much money. It takes so much energy and effort. A lot of my money went into locations. A huge chunk went into paying my crew. Well, paying for food for my crew. A lot of my crew work for free. And shout out to my Who's Your People crew, because they were amazing. And we crushed it. And I hope they all loved working, because I would love all of us to come back and work together soon. I just also wanted to shout out my co-writer, Kesslyn Blessingill, for Who's Your People, because I have had a hell of a co-writer, and she's just added such a layer to the show that it'd be impossible to talk about it without talking about how just amazing she has been as a co-writer. And yeah, so I just wanted to shout her out too.
Perfect.
But it did pay for some of my casts. I had to fly some people in, paid for covered lodging and travel for those people. Let me see, what else did it cover? Feeding my crew ended up being about 30 people.
Oh wow, that's
cast and crew together.
That's like pretty
somewhere.
Hefty. I mean, I don't know actually.
It's a pretty hefty lift for an indie project. Yeah.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, it included I had some great plugs, but it still covered rental of equipment. Like, I still had to come up with rental of equipment for lights and sound. And I had a great in-kind gift for camera. But if I would have had to come out of camera, we're talking about even bigger price point, you know?
Right.
I still didn't pay my crew. So, like, if I would have been able to pay for labor, that's a huge, you know? And we're still at 15K. Costumes, makeup, hair, art department, so props, set dressing, lighting. Yeah, I got to work with some great businesses that cut me really good deals.
Really?
For the most part,
that's awesome.
On location, so that helped. But I mean, still had to pay for that. And so, yeah, it ran up a bill very quickly.
So if you're not crowdfunding, how do you pay for this.
Blood, sweat, and tears. I have grant funded, and I was very lucky that the Arts Council of Wilmington gave me a grant to help with this project. Uptilt Film Festival gave me a grant, but they were both $1,000 grants.
Oh, wow.
$1,000 grants on a $15,000 price tag is still a lot.
Yeah.
Came out of pocket a lot. Most of it, I had in-kind things, so like things that were donated, like the equipment rentals were in-kind for camera and some of the additional camera support, lenses, things like that. Like I said, I had a lot of people who were willing to give me their time and energy and work for me in kind, which I appreciate and love, but I also hate not paying artists. So I wish I had the budget to pay my artists for their craft because they are gifted. But yeah, like I got those two grants and those in-kind things and the rest was out of mi paqueta.
Wow. Okay.
Which is not actual Spanish, by the way.
Okay, can you talk about the importance of intersectionality? Like, you've been talking about it this whole time, but let's get into it. Yeah.
Absolutely. There is this idea that is a habit for a lot of people that where we sit on the totem pole, there's a lot of people above us, but there's not necessarily a lot of people below us. And we forget that there's so many layers to the identity, and sometimes we cling on to more one thing than the other based off of the situations we're in, based around the rooms that we're in, the spaces that we're taking up or not taking up, and also the stance that we're taking. Mm-hmm. And so, like, for me, intersectionality, I noticed it a lot when I was living abroad. For the majority of my life, I've identified as just a Black woman, like a African American, whatever, descendant of slaves. We can go into like the terminologies because there's a lot around the identity of Black people in this country that descend from slaves versus Black people who have immigrated in the last 100+ years. Regardless, because that is not the conversation that we're having right now. I have always identified as a Black woman. I came from Black women. My mom was a Black woman. My grandma was a Black woman, blah, 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 blah. And we've always been in North and South Carolina. So like North Carolina, South Carolina, those are my mostly North, but a little bit of South is my identity. A Carolina Black woman. But when I lived abroad, all of a sudden I was surrounded by a lot of Americans and the outside is viewing me as just an American. But I am not necessarily culturally connecting with a lot of the other Americans that I'm there with because all of them, for the most part, are from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Montana, California. Literally no one is Southern but me.
Wow.
And also the layer of American means nothing.
Like,
I hate to, it's like culturally American means little to nothing because like we're all very different,
we're
right?
We're so diverse. Like, yeah.
The only other girl that I met while I was in Spain that was Black and from the South, she's second generation, and she's Black British Jamaican American.
Yeah.
Like, I think she was the first generation born out of Windrush in the UK. So she is a British passport holder, a British citizen. She migrated to the U.S. Her dad, Jamaican American immigrant.
Hmm.
So like she's
so
like very
different.
New generation. Yeah. And she grew up in Atlanta.
Right.
And like we're connecting, but even still, we're not the same culture.
Yeah.
Like in the sense of like there are things like, yes, we are both Black, but there are things that are specific to Jamaican culture and specifically Jamaican British culture as well that don't exist for me.
Mm.
And vice versa, there are things that like specifically are Black American culture and those that descend from that don't exist for her.
Mm.
And she's the closest person that I have. So this idea of like this Americanism that unifies us all, yes, there's language and like there's some food and there's some like regional context, but like that's just one layer. And then we're not even getting into sexuality. We're not getting into class, social class. We're not getting into gender expression. Like, there's just, like, all these other layers that add on to just race, gender, and class.
Mm-hmm.
Religion. And so, like, I started to realize there were certain situations that I really clung on to my Southernness more. And, like, mm-hmm. I've never had to do that because I've always been in North Carolina. And, like, who's being like, I'm a Southern? Like, obviously, you
right.
live here.
Right.
Like, So all of a sudden, I'm clinging on to my Southernness more in these situations, or like I'm clinging on to my Black Americanness specifically if I'm in a room with like more of the Black diaspora, because that is more relevant to me in this context than it would be if I was in a room full of all Black Americans.
Right. Oh.
And so that's when I really started getting into like, what does intersectionality truly mean for me? How does it play a role in how I view the world? How does it play a role in how others view me? Because like there is also all these layers that people perceive of people based off of where you come from. Like there was another girl who was Black American too. Her parents, like, she descended from people who were enslaved down in Arkansas. She grew up somewhere in the Midwest. And so like she has this perception of the South because she is the product of the Great Migration. Her parents moved out. Her grandparents moved out of the South because of Jim Crow. And so they settled in the Midwest. So her ideals of what being Black in the South looks like is completely different for me, whose parents stayed.
Yeah.
And did not join the Great Migration. So like there's all these like contexts and nuances that are happening all at once. And I'm just like, all of these things craft and shape how I perceive the world. And so in general, I think our art should be intersectional, but I do feel like it is something that we have to acknowledge when it's not. Because I will also say there is a privilege with some of my identity too. Although I have all these things other people may deem as quote unquote negative, the reality is like I present female, I'm able-bodied, I identify straight, and all of those things, when you add those, also change the perception. Of an intersectional world. So like,
yeah, totally.
I also have to admit that maybe my art may appear as privileged to others. There might be someone who is not able-bodied who would look at my art and see a lack of representation there or things like that. And that's also things that I think about when I'm writing characters. Was it like to have that representation, or do I need that representation? And something I think as an artist, we're always going to have to grow and work with too. Like understanding that just because I identify with this and I feel like I don't see myself represented in this, and so therefore I have to create the space for this. There's also these things that I don't identify with, but they still need to be represented in some way. We still need to look at it some way. Maybe we need to consult some way, because you also don't want to take advantage of other people's stories. You need to create space for people to tell their own stories.
Ah, so much good stuff. Oh my god.
Yay, I'm
glad. No, this is, oh my gosh. Yeah, it's like, I guess nobody's making you think about all these things, but you're just gonna think about them because like you're human and you want to tell the truth in some form.
Yeah, because the reality is 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 300 years from now, if we don't completely destroy the planet.
Right.
The things that we're creating today is going to be the artifacts of tomorrow. And so, like, if we're not thinking about these things now, if we're not representing these things now, 300 years from now, when we're gone, they're going to think that it didn't exist then. A lot of the reasons why people struggle with seeing Black and brown bodies in the Victorian age and the Gilded Age and all these, it's because they made a point not to represent them in the things that were happening then, the art that was being created then. They made a point to either whitewash them or to completely erase them. So now it's revolutionary for a Shonda Rhimes to make a Bridgerton. But the reality is Black people were still in those bodies even back then. They were existing during the like Renaissance and the Spanish Inquisition and like all of these. Black people were always here. Brown people were always here. Queer people were always here. Varied abilityed people were always here. But we don't see them because they didn't want us to see them then. But like part of what we have to do in changing the zeitgeist of how we see ourselves now and the responsibility that we have as both artists and activists, if you choose to make your art activism as well, I think there's always an inherent part of activism in art. But like, again, we could get into that later. But part of our responsibility now is to not continue to erase those people from the population because they have always been here. And even if we start today, like 300 years from now, they will still be here. And they would like to see themselves now.
I find it fascinating that you see this historical line. Like, you are part of this historical line, and art has always been part of this historical line makes so much sense as you're talking about it, you know, like art as history and art as legacy. And it's just amazing. You are shaping history with your art.
So.
It's amazing.
I hope so. Like I said, the first generation of my family to come out of slavery was born in 1792 and died in 1922. I think he was like 100 and some odd change years old. And there was an article I told you earlier that was published about him right around the time of his death in 1921 in the local paper. And one of the things that they specifically said about him was the fact that he had this amazing ability to tell story. And that was part of his legacy. Like, I never met him. I wasn't born in 1922 when he died. I have not, but I know that he was a storyteller because someone else took the time to document his ability to be a storyteller. I think there's something very powerful in that legacy. The ability to read and write is still very new. Like, we think about it as a very common practice now, but literacy is a very new concept. There are a lot of people whose families immigrated here within the past 125 years who did not have the ability to read and write. But the history is still being documented and the history is still being recorded, even if it's orally. There are stories that are so old, we don't even know where they come from.
Yeah.
And it's a form of art.
Yes.
And so, like, I always think about art in the fact of, like, when I'm dead and gone, what are the stories that I told here gonna leave behind for the generations to come? I remember I watched a documentary years ago, maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, and I can't remember what it's called. I want to say it was called Seven Seeds. I really hate that I misquoted it. It was about an indigenous filmmaker. But the crux of the documentary was the seeds that we plant today were the fruit of the generations before us, and it's going to be the fruit of the generations after us. So it's not just thinking about what we do right now in the sense of, I did this with the sense of my ancestors laid a foundation for me to be able to be here to do this. And what I have to do in return is to plant the seed so that the generations after me can bear the fruit that maybe I don't see in this lifetime.
Oh, this is amazing. So how much of art do you think is like imagining a future and how much of it is representing the present?
Both.
It's both.
I think it's both. Imagining a future is manifesting in the sense of if we speak it into existence now, then we're making a conscious decision to work towards it, or at least we're trying to make the step towards it. I think that's why we cling to things that seem hopeful. Even if the product of it is not what we expect or what we can see. But I think, you know, what it is right now is what we have. That's our context. We don't know anything. We don't know what next week is going to bring. We don't know what next month is going to bring. We don't even know what 10 hours from now is going to bring, to be honest. When we leave this podcast, we have no clue what's going to happen. But so all we can talk about is the here and now.
Yeah.
But we also see the flaws in the here and now. And even if it's optimistic to think of a more like whatever inclusive, peaceful, whatever you want to say, world, our art is both representing how we see it now, but I think there's elements of it that is manifesting what it should be. You know, like even if it's adding that one character that is representing something that we don't really talk about a lot now, but we should be.
Yeah.
Like the conversation for Who's Your People is about last name, right? We talk about it in like a nonchalant way, but like, we don't really talk about the why a lot, even though we should be. We should be talking about the why now. So I think a little bit of it is just acknowledging what life is like now. Social media influencers happen now. It's a lucrative business. It's crazy that we're at that space because I remember, I think when I was in Spain back in 2016, an Italian university had offered an influencing course, and it was like this most ridiculous sounding thing at the time,
right?
And it's like now people are making entire livings off of influencing, and
at
a time where like I said, like, and we're talking about from 2016 until 2023, that's not even a decade. Like, I just remember the conversation being like, who's gonna take a course on Instagram,
right?
You know, like, that sounds so crazy. I wouldn't waste my education on Instagram, but like, now look,
right?
There's whole social media managers as positions in Fortune 500 companies.
Yep. It's crazy.
And so, and we don't even know where that space is going to continue to grow to.
Right.
And so it's like, maybe we should be having conversations more about what is it for a person whose full-time job is that? What is it for a person who's growing up in a like southern town where these pressures, where, what is it like for a black woman who, I mean, educationally speaking, most black women are one of the highest performing groups as far as education. We're one of the highest educated group of women. But what does that mean now? What does it mean? So, like, I just wanted something that talked about that, but also created a space where it's like it's healthy to have the dialogue.
Yes.
Because it's right now, it's still very toxic to have the dialogue. You get online, you see a lot of podcasts where it's like, well, if she doesn't take your last name, then she's a masculine woman. You know, like the Alpha Man podcast, where it's just like, well, maybe she just is a doctor.
Right, right.
Like... maybe she's got assets tied up to like there to this last name that it's like a pain to change. Like,
yeah,
maybe she's the last one in her family to carry that last name. Maybe if she changes her name, that bloodline dies out. And that's not everybody's situation, but you just don't know.
Yeah. So. Oh my gosh. I am so fascinated by this. And I love listening to you talk about it because I can see you like lighting up. Like, you're so passionate about this. I'm really.
Yeah, I really love this. Project.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So what's something that you are currently learning or working through in your creative process or in your creative work or just in your human self, because that's our creative selves as well.
Oof. It's okay to take breaks.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's okay to not always be productive. I've had to relearn and retrain myself, and I'm still working on it, on what productivity looks like. Productivity does not always mean I got 7 things on the to-do list crossed off or that I spent X amount of time on the computer. So I'm having to relearn that product isn't everything. In the sense of, I'm not in competition with turning out a product to meet where other people are in their processes.
That's so hard to remember.
It's very, very hard. Yeah. And it's something that I always am constantly grappling with, because to what I was telling you earlier, like, I chose the production crew route for paying bills and the indie work as my part-time. And so that means... that right now I create when I can. There are people who did it differently. There's people who moved. I also decided to stay in the Southeast to be a filmmaker. I didn't decide to go to one of the bigger hubs.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that I know that chose to go to the New Yorks and the LAs. And being at peace with my decisions for what I thought was best for me as an artist. And I chose to stay in the Southeast because, as I've told you before, I'm a Southern filmmaker. Like, that's just who I am. It's the stories that I tell. And to me, it felt crazy to leave the South to tell stories about the South.
Right.
And trying to get people who I already know don't care about Southern stories to care about Southern stories.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I say that because, like, we talked about, you know, regional biases and all these things. And so for me, it felt ludicrous to leave the South when I'm so influenced by the South as an artist. And that's where my muse comes from. But it's a slower climb. Like, it's taken a certain level of patience, a certain level of consistency, a certain level of not looking at what my comrades that went to New York and LA and all these bigger hubs, what they're doing, because what they're doing is not what I'm doing. And also learning to praise people for the work that they're doing and not let my own little green eye of envy monitoring that eye, because it's so easy, especially when you feel like you're giving everything, to see somebody get, you know, into a film festival or awarded a grant or blah, 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 and be like, well, screw them because I know they haven't been working as hard as me.
Right,
you know,
right.
Like, or whatever, but my journey is my journey. The work that I'm doing is what I'm doing. And I'm not saying what they're doing is not as invaluable or important, but I knew that when I decided to stay in the South, there were going to be sacrifices. There were also going to be gains. I feel like the stories that I'm telling are so in purpose and in alignment for where I am as a human right now and the legacy that I want to leave behind when I'm gone. And I don't know if they would be the same if I would have left and went to a bigger hub. Now, I might have moved up the ladder quicker. Who knows? But I don't know if my stories would be the same. I don't know if I would be the same. I don't know if I would enjoy it the same way. And so, yeah, just learning that it's okay to take breaks, that it's okay to not to keep up with the Joneses. It's okay that productivity may look like I just watched the news today and knitted.
Yes.
And like I just took my dog for a walk.
Right.
On the river and I got beignets. You know, like it's okay that those days will happen and I don't have to beat myself up tomorrow because it didn't happen today.
It's so hard to remember, but mm-hmm. thank you for bringing that up because I think all of us are working through that in some way.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's on Instagram and social media makes it so much harder because you're just seeing people promoting their work left, right, and center. And you're like, I'm so close to having something to promote, but I just don't have it quite yet. And I feel like I should be pushing it so I have something to promote. But da, 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 and it's just like, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. Let's do a couple of rapid fire questions to end. Okay. So what gives you joy?
What gives me joy? Coffee.
Fuck yeah. What's one thing that you do to have a more peaceful day?
Knitting.
What motivates you?
My grandma.
My grandma motivates me too.
Yeah.
What's one lesson that stuck with you?
My grandma always said that it is a sorry frog that does not praise its own pond. And that always stuck with me. So I'm going to say that it's a sorry frog that doesn't praise its own pond.
I love that. What's your favorite quote or mantra?
Oh, actually, I have to look it up because okay. I just found one that really, really liked. It was a Shirley Chisholm quote.
Okay.
And it's, service is the rent we pay for the privilege of living on this earth. And I loved that because there's always something that we can do in service. And I think as artists, part of what we do is a service, whether it's validating people's experience, whether it's being a historian, recording the things of this time, whether it's giving people an anthem to cling on to. Service is something that we all can do, even if it's not creative. Service, you can give service through time. You can give service through nurturing. You can give service through being a listening ear. But yeah, I really had never heard that quote before. But yeah, service is the rent we pay for living on this earth.
Thank you so much, Anna Rae. Like, seriously.
I think I talked your ear off. So.
Now we're going to go get some food.
Yes, wings.
Let's go eat. Wow. What did I tell you? So much amazing stuff in there. For a closer look at Anna Rae's incredible work in film and storytelling, go to the link in the show notes. Once you're on the Portrayed Productions website, scroll down to subscribe to their newsletter and social media for updates on ways to support their journey. The Process is produced by Sienna Facciolo, edited by Jessica Liu and Sienna Facciolo. Our theme music, Winter Woods, is written and performed by Sienna Facciolo, Chris Pallas, and Jordan Rabinowitz, featuring Sally Louise on guitar. Mixed by Chris Pallas, mastered by Jet Galindo. The Process is presented in partnership with Rochester Groovecast. For exclusive content and never-before-heard interviews, you can become a patron of The Process today at patreon.com/Sienna Facciolo. That's patreon.com/SienaFacciolo. The link to join is in the show notes.